Council Labor and Commerce will now come to order. It's 3:22 on April 13th, and with us we have Representative Chenault, Representative Holmes, Representative Boop, Representative Lynn, myself, Chair Olson. We've got a quorum. Please turn off your cell phones, or you're going to be buying us bagels and salmon spread, I think, this time. Turns off, Jerry?
Yeah. I can't even find one.
First item on the agenda today, and we've been joined by Representative Newman. First item on the agenda today is House Bill 144, Uniform Probate Code. Jane, please join us and state your name and affiliation for the record.
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Jay Ramirez. And I'm here today to introduce House Bill 144. House Bill 144 will keep Alaska in a position as the premier states for trust and estate planning. It provides the following amendments to the Uniform Probate Code to facilitate the administration of wills and trusts in Alaska. It adds provisions allowing the settlor of a trust to designate a representative who can represent or bind an incapacitated person in future proceedings relating to the trust administration. It established that an augmented estate does not include property transferred to an irrevocable trust if the settlor is a discretionary beneficiary of the trust and if the transfer is made more than 30 days before marriage or with the consent of the decedent's spouse. The provision is similar to statutory provisions adopted in Delaware. And an augmented estate consists of property owned by both the deceased person and his or her spouse. Its value is calculated only if the surviving spouse declines whatever he or she is left by the will and instead claims a share of the decedent spouse's estate that is statutorily determined by state law. House Bill 144 further creates a procedure for an establishment of a will and a trust validity before death. Situations arise where there is a question concerning a person's capacity to execute a will or a trust, or whether the document was executed as a result of undue influence, duress, fraud, or mistake. The new procedure will allow these issues to be brought before the court while the testator or settlor is alive and when evidence is fresh. Similar procedures are allowed in three other states. It will further provide a venue for a probate proceeding if the decedent is not domiciled in Alaska, but significant assets are located within the state. The passage of House Bill 144 will ensure that Alaska stays the premier state in which to establish trusts and estates. And I'll be happy to go through the sectional if you would like.
Please.
Section 1 of the bill amends AS 1306-122, which lists the situation when persons are bound by orders binding others in proceedings under the Uniform Probate Code. It allows a person designated by a trust instrument to represent and bind a born or unborn trust beneficiary. It allows the settlor to designate the person in the trust in various ways. It generally does not allow a designated person serving as a trustee to represent and bind the beneficiaries, and it generally does not allow the designated person to represent and bind a beneficiary if the designated person is also a beneficiary. Section 1 also provides that certain persons who represent other persons under AS 1306-122A through F are not liable for good faith acts and omissions to the beneficiaries whose interests are represented or to persons claiming through those beneficiaries. Section 2 amends AS 1312-201-B9, and it makes grammatical and conforming amendments to the definition of transfers for certain provisions of the Uniform Probate Code that relates to elective share or surviving spouses. Section 3 amends AS 1312-205, which relates to a decedent's non-probate transfers to other persons and delegates an irrevocable transfer in trust with a transfer restriction from the property that is not included in the augmented estate. Section 4 adds AS 1312-205B, which provides that the augmented estate does not include property transferred to an irrevocable trust with a transfer restriction if two conditions relating to the settlor's trust, the trust settlor, and the transfer timing are met. Section 5 makes conforming amendments to Section 4 of the bill, as does Section 6. and Section 7. Section 8 adds a new set of sections that provide for establishing the validity of wills and trusts before the testator's death. 530 allows certain persons to petition the court to determine the validity of a will. Section 535 allows certain persons to petition the court to determine the validity of the will before a person's death. 540 establishes the venue. 545 identifies what a petition for will validity must contain, as does 550. Section 555 authorizes a court to declare a will or trust to be valid, declares that the will has full legal effect and must be admitted to probate on request of the testator's death, unless modified or revoked after the court's decision. 560 makes the court's validity declaration binding on other persons. 565 directs the court to hold a hearing after a petition is filed, requires the petitioner to notify the spouse, children, heirs, and testator or settlor. For a will also requires the petitioner to notify the testator, the personal representative nominated in the will, and devisees under the will. For a trust, it also requires the petitioner to notify the settlor and parties in interest. 570 establishes burden of proof for petitions. 575 allows a testator to modify or revoke the will after the court's declaration. 580 allows the trust to be modified, terminated, revoked, or reformed after the court's declaration. 585 establishes which records related to the petition are public, which are available only to certain persons, and which are confidential. Allows the court to order confidential records to be made available to other persons when good cause is shown. 590 defines the term used in the new article. Section 9 amends 1316.410 and allows a personal representative to consider discretionary distributions to a beneficiary as being made from capital gains during the year. Section 10 amends AS 1336.109 and allows trustees to consider discretionary distributions to a beneficiary as being made from capital gains realized during the year. Section 11 indicates how certain provisions of the bill amends court rules. And Section 12 states that those sections that amend the court rules only take effect if the bill, Section 11, is approved by a two-thirds vote. And that's the bill.
Didn't we change this last year?
Chair Olson, we go through these every 2 years in a cycle, and the reason we do it is because Alaska, like Delaware, is one of the premier places for trust estates and for people to keep their money, having no income tax. Therefore, we try to stay on the cutting edge, and there is a lot of benefit for the state. There is between $20 to $50 million in our banks, which can be used by our citizens and our businesses. And there's also income that comes into the state from the 6% tax on any insurance premiums that are sold. So it's free money for the state.
Representative Booth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In Section 3, 1312, 205, you're talking about decedent's non-probate transfers. Could you describe how the transfers are conducted? This is sort of a personal question. I'm just trying to figure out the differences between where I came from and this state's probate and non-probate transfers.
Representative Bush, through the chair. I'll tell you, Dave Schaftel, who is one of the premier trust attorneys, is on the line, and I think I'd rather feel more comfortable having him explain it than to me to take it.
Yeah, we'll be getting to him in a minute.
Okay, that'd be fine. Thank you.
I'd like the record to reflect we've been joined by Representative Coghill, so we do have a full committee. Any further questions for the sponsor's representative? Got off light again. So we'll bring up David Schaftel. Are you with us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. I'm one of an informal group of attorneys and trust officers who have worked with the legislature since 1997, really, in this area of estate and trust state laws, and I've worked on this bill and on many of the others that you've had before you. Just to kind of follow up a little bit on Jane Pearson's comments, but more locally, she commented about how legislation in this area has helped the state financially in terms of drawing financial business from outside of Alaska. But I think more importantly, what I find is that every one of my clients, the vast majority of whom are residents of the state of Alaska, are benefiting by what you've done in this area. And I think one thing that perhaps sometimes is overlooked is we appear before you often, but we are the one area of the law that every resident of the state of Alaska is going to be affected by at one point or another, either by virtue of their relatives passing away or their own deaths. Nobody seems to escape the estate and trust laws, and they're important to all of your constituents and all of our friends and neighbors. Unlike other areas of the law, which in the tort law, you may get involved with that if you have an automobile accident, or contract law, you may get involved with that in some commercial transaction, but most people aren't affected by those laws. But really, everybody's affected by these provisions that are this body of law, which we call estate and trust statutes in Alaska. So it really is very significant for all the residents inside the state, as well as bringing money from outside the state. I've worked on this particular bill and would be happy to try and respond to questions about it. In essence, I think the important changes that this bill makes, Jane Pearson pointed out that it facilitates someone being able to designate a representative who can stand for incapacitated people. For example, Mr. Chairman, if you were drafting a will or a trust for your children and grandchildren, you might want to say that you're going to designate a certain person, and if you have minor grandchildren or minor great-grandchildren who might be affected by some court proceeding relating to your estate or your trust, that designated person can stand in and make decisions for them. And that's what this designated representative provision accomplishes. We copied it from a recent Florida statute that was enacted, and we think it'll come in handy and avoid a lot of more complex court proceedings and then avoid the need of having to appoint guardians ad litem, which are additional attorneys, to represent either minor children or unborn children or grandchildren or descendants or incapacitated persons. Another important change that this statute accomplishes is it allows a person, again, Mr. Chairman, taking, let's say, hypothetically, your situation. Years from now, decades from now, you're elderly, and you...
won't be that long. I'm here.
Notice I said decades. And you have, perhaps, a relative who you feel might challenge your will. And you... Now, one thing that happens now is... it just would be after your death that relative could come in and say, you know, Representative Olson, he was incapacitated, or he suffered from, another one of my relatives came in and exerted undue influence or duress or fraud, and that's why he wrote his will the way he wrote it, and I want to challenge that will. Well, you're not around anymore, and you can't stand up for your will. What this new provision allows is a you can go into court right now and say, I want to have a determination as to the fact that this will that I have drafted was done while I had capacity. There was no duress involved, no fraud, no undue influence. I'm going to give notice to all interested persons and all my relatives, and if they want to challenge that, they come in and challenge it right now while I'm here to stand up for it. And while the evidence is fresh as of the time that I executed this document, we think this is it will be a very valuable type of proceeding, both for Alaska residents and even for non-residents of Alaska who want to take advantage of it. It's unique in that while there are three other states that have these types of proceedings, none of them have, and they're called their advisory opinions that these states allow the courts to do in this area. None of them are as well written as this provision, so we think we'll be a leader in this area. But I know it will be taken advantage of by some of my clients who are Alaska residents, and of course, the whole field is hoping that maybe people who aren't Alaska residents might decide to take advantage of it as well. So it's an important new novel proceeding that all of us who practice in this area full-time, we see these situations again and again, and it's very unfortunate to see a capacity challenge after death and have the whole family dragged through court proceedings and litigation that would otherwise have been unnecessary.
Yeah.
The statute also changes a venue provision that clarifies that a non-resident of Alaska can have a venue for a probate of assets either located in Alaska or even assets that aren't located in Alaska. It makes some changes to one tax change dealing with a personal representative or trustee's discretionary distributions, allows the personal representative or trustee to designate those as capital gain, which in some situations will allow for tax savings. So that's kind of a summary of the important provisions. I think it's a very good statute, and I urge you to give it consideration and would hope you approve it.
Did you hear Mr. Booth's question to Jane?
I did, but maybe it would be helpful if Representative Booth could repeat it and tell me what he's thinking of. Did you come from another state, Representative, or through the chair?
Through the chair, yeah, didn't we all? It seems as though we all ended up here. Most of us ended up here.
Minority.
Anyway, I was just, this is a rare opportunity to get on the record your expertise, and actually I'm more interested in you telling some of those in the room and those listening in the dangers of not having a will. So could you go over briefly in the normal state of affairs what happens in this state when people do not have a will in a normal scenario, not a worst case scenario as you're trying to deal with here, but as one of, you know, the norm that you would run through and those procedures, so that those of us that don't have a will could get the benefit of your advice.
I'd be happy to, through the chair, Representative Luke. If you don't have a will in the state of Alaska, and really in most states they have a similar kind of proceeding, you're considered to have died intestate. And as a result, the state has a will for you. But the first thing that would happen would be that there would be proceedings, somewhat like probate proceedings, in state court, and the court would go ahead and appoint a manager for that process, an administrator of your intestate estate. That may well not be somebody who you would have chosen or would have wanted to be administering your estate, and your estate really is all of the assets, everything you owned at the date of your death. That manager would then go through the process of gathering together all of your assets and valuing them and paying the income and federal transfer tax, the federal estate taxes that have to be paid, notifying creditors and paying creditors and hopefully challenging faulty and false creditor claims. And again, since you didn't choose the manager, you don't have the ability to choose somebody who really would stand up for you in that situation. You just have to rely on that person being competent. After all that is done, then your assets would be distributed according to a pattern that the state has laid out for you. If you have a surviving spouse and you have surviving children, a portion of the assets would go to your surviving spouse and the rest would go to your children. If you don't have a surviving spouse, then they'd end up going to your children, but they may end up going outright, or they would end up going outright rather than in trust. And very often we find it's much more valuable to have assets held in trust. You can protect those assets, provide better management, better investment. You can make distributions according to the needs of young people rather than their desires or urges. You can provide for better tax planning. So there are a whole variety of things that you can do if you do the planning yourself. But if you don't do that planning, then the state has a very skeletal type of plan for you, which is as I described. We find that in our office, occasionally we will have these situations brought in by surviving spouses or surviving adult children, and we go through this process with them and with the court. It's more expensive. It often results in poor tax planning. It often results in assets going in directions that the person who died never would have wanted them to go in those directions if they'd thought it out. So it's really, it can be a tragedy for the family if they don't plan in this area. So I'll stop there and let you follow up if I haven't answered all the areas you'd like me to comment on.
Paul? Through the chairman. No, you've, I think that's the proper admonishment that I was trying to get across through your legalese to our layman's ears. And I think it's very important that for those of us in listening distance that we caretake for these issues, and I really appreciate the sponsors taking the initiative to alleviate even further dilemmas should there be some contest of those wills. So thank you very much for your testimony and your expertise.
Representative Coghill, followed by Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is not going to take long for me to get in over my head, but the question is in Section 3 under the descendants' non-probate transfers to others, and it goes to these non-probate transfers under Section 2. You have these following forms that can be by the descendant during marriage, and you take out the part including an irrevocable transfer in trust with a transfer restriction. And I was looking under the restriction, and there's a whole range of things under that 34.4.110A. Can you explain to me why you want to take the restrictions 34.40 out?
Well, yes, and this is really deals with a very narrow right, and it's what's called the widow's election. If you don't provide for your spouse in your will, your spouse can elect against your will and can take one-third of the combined assets of the family and make sure that she receives at least one-third of the combined assets that you and your spouse have. And that's called the widow's election. The augmented estate is what you gather together and then take one-third of that. Now, there's a type of trust in Alaska that was initiated in 1997 and now has been copied by 11 other states. There are now 12 states that have this, but we were the leader. And it is an irrevocable trust, and that let's assume, Representative, that you create this trust. And what's nice about this trust is you can be a discretionary beneficiary of the trust, as well as members of your family. You can put assets into this trust, and yet your creditors cannot reach the assets in the trust. Now, that's different from the way the law was prior to 1997 in most states. That's called a self-settled trust. And if you, in most states, if you create a self-settled trust, you put the assets in, and you are a beneficiary, your creditors can reach the assets in that trust to the maximum extent that the trustee could make distributions back to you. And so if you have a trustee who has absolute discretion to make distributions to you, your spouse, and your children, well, the maximum extent that that trustee could make distributions to you would be all of the trust's assets. And that would mean that your creditors could reach all of the assets in that trust. So we changed that law in 1997, and it was so popular that 11 other states have followed us. Now, where it becomes important, we've said that in terms of a husband and wife, if before you were married, and remember, these trusts are set up, they don't avoid creditors that exist at the time you set them up. That wasn't the purpose of it. The purpose of it was to allow people to set up a trust, put some money away, and be sure that that money was safe in the future. If in the future they had an accident or some other kind of event and they had a judgment against them. But it doesn't protect against existing creditors when you create that trust. Well, if you create that trust before you are married, 30 days before you're married, then it's protected against even claims of a spouse in a divorce. But that's if you do it before you're married. Or if your spouse consents to that trust being created after you're married. So, you know, your wife could say, go ahead, create one of these trusts. I think it's a great idea. It can be for you and for the kids. Not for me. I'm going to consent to that. And if there's a divorce, your wife wouldn't receive any of those assets. That's if she consented. Or if you did it 30 days before marriage or more before marriage than 30 days. Now, when we did all that, we failed to, and this is probably this group that I told you about that work on these laws, we failed to conform what's called the widow's election. And that means that in this hypothetical that we're talking about, you created one of these trusts, you created it before you were married, you put a certain amount of assets in it and designated where it would go at your death. Then when you die, your wife decides to elect against the estate. Well, what this provision that you referred to and asked a question about says is, she cannot include in that augmented estate this trust that you created before marriage. Nor could she include in that augmented estate that she's electing against a trust that she consented to after marriage. And that's really what this change does that is referred to in sections 3 and 4 of this bill.
Follow?
No, that's probably more information than I can digest, but I after reading the 34-4110A and listening to that explanation, it looks like I did not know about the widow's trust issue. So my guess is the transfer is under that section. So I will ponder that with that explanation. That was a very detailed explanation. So
I'm sorry I can't make it simpler, but without that background, I don't think it would make sense.
Yeah, no, it almost has to be reduced to a formula for some of us guys, but I think that'll help. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, if we made it simpler, we probably wouldn't need attorneys, but Representative Holmes.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, my question was, I think, pretty much identical to the path we just went down, so I think I'm going to pass it this time.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chaptel. And Doug Blotmacher, are you with us? Doug?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Please state your name and affiliation, and we have our undivided attention.
My name is Douglas Blotmacher, and I'm the president of Alaska Trust Company, and we strongly support this legislation.
Well, thank you. Is that it? Do you have more?
Not unless you have any questions, Chairman.
Nope, that's perfect. Thank you very much. Any questions for Doug? We also have Rich Holmpeck, but I think your question's only, aren't you, Rich?
Yes, I'm here.
Care to make a statement or just a question still?
I'm available for questions, Mr. Chairman, but I'd just like to state that I support the bill. And I have some clients right now who have asked me to petition the court for determination that their wills are valid as soon as this legislation is passed, because they have a situation where their son may contest their will.
Hmm. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Do we have anybody online at the LIOs that would care to testify on this bill? None. Do we have anybody in the room? None. With that, we'll close out public testimony and bring it back to the committee for discussion. Any questions for Jane?
I have one.
Representative Booth?
Through the chair, Jane, how long did you work on this piece of legislation?
Representative Booth, through the chair, this has been in the works since before the session started.
I can imagine. Well, I really appreciate your time and counsel on this, and if any of us have any question as this works its way through, I'm sure that you're more than competent to explain it in detail to us. So thanks very much.
For the chair, I'll try my best.
You can plead the Fifth Amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions for Jane?
The only question brought up in mind is, I have to redo my will.
Is that a question or a statement?
No, it's a statement. I'm sorry.
Yeah, we could sleep on this till Wednesday, or I could entertain a motion to move it out of committee.
Mr. Chair, if there's no more committee discussion, I move House Bill number 144, version /A, from committee with any individual recommendations or attached fiscal notes.
Seeing no opposition, the bill moves out of committee. We'll take a brief at ease to sign up. Agenda is House Bill 207, Maximum Benefit from the Fisherman's Fund. And it looks like we've got John Bittney carrying the bill for Representative Harris. Welcome, John.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Bittney. I work as an aide to Representative John Harris, as prime sponsor of House Bill 207. I'll just be brief. I think the bill is relatively simple, and the Fisherman's Fund is a fund that provides essentially what's similar to workers' compensation benefits for commercial fishermen. It's been around since 1951. Since 1959, the upper limit in state law on claims from the fund has been established at $2,500. Since 1959, health care costs have risen, and what's before you today is a piece of legislation that takes that limitation up to $10,000. It's essentially a one-section bill in front of you there, not counting the effective date, obviously. And I would just point out on line 5 of the bill where it talks about except for compelling reasons, and it gets into setting the limitation at the amount we're talking about here. I just wanted the committee to be aware in considering the bill that there is a board that if a fisherman were to be injured and had a claim that would exceed the amount that you have here, they can go discuss that with the board and get approval. So It's not like everybody's been just capped at the $2,500. There are claims that have exceeded that, but it requires the injured fishermen or their family to go through the process of getting that. So raising the limit, I think, would help sort of speed up the processing of those claims a little bit. The fund is paid for by the fees that commercial fishermen pay for their crew licenses and their permits. My understanding is it has a balance of a little over $11 million now, so that it should be able to handle, if you will, by raising this upper limit. There are some management provisions that the agency has in administering the fund. If it got to be a situation where claims begin to draw the fund down to a point where something needs to be done, they can either take a harder look at some of the medical claims as they come in and do some other things, with the idea that those would sort of keep the fund in a healthy financial state without having to increase taxes and fees on commercial fishermen in order to for the fund. Mr. Chairman, I think the bill is that simple. Certainly the agency is here to speak on behalf of the bill if the committee wishes to get into any questions about how it's administered or anything like that. I'm certainly available for any questions I can answer as a sponsor.
And that would be Kevin Adams?
Mr. Chairman, Kevin Adams works as a consultant for our office and brought this issue forward to us and has been helping us with the thing. It was sort of his idea, and we've brought it here before you, but the Department of Labor is here, I believe, to get into any questions about how the fund itself, how claims are administered.
Probably sitting right behind Kevin. But
yes.
Any questions for John, Representative Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, you had a comparison in the sponsor statement from $1,959, and it updates it to a fund limit of $10,000. But it, in today's prices, it'd be worth approximately $18,000 plus. Why not $18,000? Why don't you bring it up to $18,000?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, the goal was is to sort of, if you will, increase it to a reasonable amount to make sure that we weren't increasing it such that claims would sort of chase the upper limit that's set in statute and force, as part of this legislation, some sort of increase in the fees that people have to pay. Our intent with this is that the fees that are paid into the fund by fishermen every year should essentially remain the same and not have to do something that somehow would raise the claims where that would become a necessary part of this legislation.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the $10,000 limit is where you feel it will not jeopardize the sustainability of the fund, and that's the upper limit?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, obviously we've just made what I would call a reasonable guess at what that upper limit should be without doing that. The answer to your question is yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cargill.
Thank you. How many claims under this $2,500 have had to go beyond the allowance?
Mr. Chairman, I apologize that I don't have the number of claims. We heard this bill in the Fisheries Committee, and some of that information came forward. There was a discussion of what's the high end of the claim. I know that there's been claims of that approach. I believe the testimony was $100,000 for congestive heart failure that happened.
I'm
but
sorry, Mr. Chairman.
I would just
I meant how many individuals have had to ask for an allowance beyond the $2,500.
I beg your pardon, Mr. Chairman, Representative Cargill. I need to seek some help from the department.
I think that would make the case for it, quite frankly.
I think we're going to have Paul up in a couple minutes. Representative Burke.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to refer to those questions. I was one sitting on the Fisheries Committee. We did get some detail from, was it Trina, who was the head, and if she's here, I think your questions will be answered as well. So,
any further questions for John? So is Trina here? Please join us.
Got a gaggle.
Oh, okay. Well,
gaggle.
Oh,
nice. For the record, my name is Tarina Hikas. I'm the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. I brought with me today also our program fund coordinator for the Fisherman's Fund, Mr. Mike Monagle. So if there's a statistical analysis the committee would like to hear, Mr. Monagle could certainly address that question.
Welcome. Representative Cargill. Representative Cargill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, to whoever can answer this, obviously the $2,500 limit has been a low limit, so that means that the allowances have had to be accepted fairly regularly, I'm sure. So I was just wondering if that is just a normal occurrence, and this is does this bring us into a place where the allowance or the variance is going to be different? So that's why we're fishing for that $10,000 number over the $2,500 number.
I'll go ahead and have Mr. Monagle answer that question for you.
For the record, my name is Mike Monagle. I'm a program coordinator for the Department of Labor, the fund administrator, through the chair, Representative Coghill. There are about 60 claims. We just did an analysis in fiscal year 09 that fall between $2,500 and $10,000. And going back the previous 5 years in FY 08, it was 63, FY 07 at 65. So it seems to fall around between 50 and 70 claims a year that exceed 2,500 but are less than 10,000. And what we find typically is that when we respond back to the fishermen that say you've exceeded the $2,500 limit and you have to fill out some more paperwork to have your claim approved above that limit, a large degree of these claimants never come back to us. I assume they pay out of pocket or they pay from some other source. Those claims above 10,000 tend to come back to us because of the severity of their claim. And I think to address an earlier question, we have about 26 to 30 claims a year that go to council for this reason, because the amount of the claim is over 2,500. And a lot of times those are catastrophic types of claims where the amount of medical treatment is 20, 30. I think someone testified that we had one at the spring council meeting that was over 200,000, which is true. Those are rare to have that excessive of a claim, but the council has to consider each of those claims. The reason that the 10,000 limit would make a difference, we hold council meetings twice a year. And for someone seeking treatment or getting their bills paid, they have to wait 6 months before we can get a response from the council and get that claim approved for the medical treatment they need.
Paul? So then it's a matter of severity that really what you'd think of is the 10,000 as a baseline rather than a cap, basically, because if there was a need to go beyond that, they would just put in whatever request. And then at the next regularly held meeting, they would go for that. What is the likelihood under hospitalization that would normally be, that would pay out the $10,000 without question, but they ask for an allowance beyond that? What are the I hate to use the word chances. What is this the probability scale that says we're probably going to pay that anyway? Just out of curiosity.
Through the chair, Representative Kalka, I'm not quite sure I understand the question.
Well, right now it looks like over 2,500. If they go ahead and make the application, you will go ahead and make the allowance, and that you have money sufficient to pay for that. So we're going to move it up to $10,000. I'm trying to get a feel for if $10,000 under today's medical costs are. Would we consider that a baseline, but a severity high enough that they would probably apply for an allowance beyond that?
Well, what we did is we took a look at a couple of our what I would consider a basic claim. For example, you strain your back and you go to the doc, and he says, "Well, I need to do an MRI." So they do an MRI. That MRI, depending on the type of MRI, can cost anywhere from $2,500 to $3,500, $4,000 in Alaska prices, just for that test. Then you've got the office visits, follow-up office visits, and then you qualify for usually some type of chiropractic treatment or physical therapy. That claim itself can easily be around $5,000 or $6,000, and that's a pretty common occurrence, you know, considering the type of occupation and the type of work that these persons do. We see a lot of back strain type claims, and so the $10,000 limit, I think, was an attempt to accommodate the more frequent or common types of claims that would occur. Does that answer your question?
Yep. Yeah, I think I was looking for the reason that you would want to make an allowance beyond $10,000, and it would be just a normal process of saying the costs are just beyond that and there's a legitimate claim. It would go to a board question, though, true?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Caulfield, we screen administratively, we screen the claim to make sure it complies with eligibility under the statute. So, you know, obviously we make sure that the person was injured during commercial fishing. So we do some preliminary investigation to make sure it's a valid claim. But at that point, we are strictly looking at the cost of medical treatment. It exceeds $10,000 and needs to have that approved by our council.
Okay. So just, Mr. Chairman, it looks to me like administratively, for regular injuries, this would be probably within reason. For the heart attack issue, it's probably going to get a variance or an allowance request beyond that on a pretty regular basis. So, but as long as the hurdle isn't insurmountable, but the $10,000 is reasonable. I was just looking for some way to gauge that. So thank you,
Representative Book.
Mr. Chairman, in the Fisheries Committee, there was a couple of things that were divulged, and you were hit up with a couple of the largest payments in the history of the fund this past year, to the tune of about $250,000. Is that correct? Cumulatively?
Through the chair, that would be correct. One was the council just approved 2 weeks ago at our council meeting, one a payment for about $162,000 on $205,000 in medical expenses. And the other one, a few months ago, they approved payment of about $100,000 for a gentleman who had lost his arm in a winch.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, if I might continue. So we're looking at, because of this thing sitting at this particular payout rate for two decades nearly, and that the fact is that this fund is at $11 million, looking like that this is a consideration well within the limits of the fees that are contributed, and that this is a sustainable limit that you're looking at, and so you're in agreement with this, with the sponsors. Bill, on this?
Through the chair, the department does support the bill. Okay. There's currently about $11.4 million in that fund, and we've been running the last few years, I believe, at a slight deficit of around $100,000, but given the revenue and the amount that's in the fund now, we don't anticipate any problem.
Through the chair, thank you.
Paul, that's it?
That's it.
Representative Chenault.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, that probably gets more down to my point. You said that there's about $11.4 million in there. Could you tell me, above that, in the sponsor statement, talks about crew members pay 39% or up to $50 a piece. Can you tell me what the average payout is of the fund itself?
On claims in excess of
the $2,500.
I'll have Mr.
Monaco
answer that question.
Through the chair, Representative Chenault. There are, last fiscal year, FY08, there were 766 claims. The average claim cost was $1,075. The fund paid out $823,000 in benefits. The claims above, the current limit of $2,500, There are approximately two dozen claims a year that go forward, and they vary from, you know, being $3,000 to, as the director mentioned, a couple of very large claims in excess of $100,000 and $200,000. But the average of our council meetings, they typically approve between $200,000 and $300,000 in extensions, extended benefit requests. So we have two meetings a year. So we're talking $300,000 to $400,000 in extension requests
at each meeting.
At each meeting. Well, for the total year, yes.
Right. About $600,000 or so total for the year. What is the income to the fund, or what was the income? I have a number here that I just penciled out, but
The FY08 revenue was $1,044 and change.
$1 million.
I'm sorry, $1 million.
I get confused.
Yes. Yeah. One more comment in there.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Burke.
I think my question was answered. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions? Thanks.
Thank you.
With that, I think we'll open up. Paula.
Yes, sir.
Please stay for one question.
Yes, sir.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
For the record, my name is Paula Scavere. I'm Special Assistant Legislative Liaison to Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Has the administration taken a position on this bill?
The administration supports this bill.
Thank you. Any questions for Paula while we have her here? Thanks again. Is there anybody? I'm going to open it up to, do you want Paula or
Paula? I just can ask how that happened.
How did it happen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That the administration agreed, or?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're supporting.
With that, we'll open up public testimony. Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify? Welcome back, Jerry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name is Jerry McKean. I represent United Fishermen of Alaska. All 37 groups agree with this bill. I'll throw in a little bit of information that wasn't said, that crew members pay $23.40 out of their crew license. Fishermen are capped at $50 for every commercial fisherman's licensed. So that, and then you pay administration fee of $307, if I'm not mistaken, to the Department of Labor. And I met with the Fishermen's Fund Board in the Department of Labor for 3 days on this issue and some others, but particularly on this issue. It just lets the fishermen have, and the hospitals and everybody know, that you have a little bit more upfront money that you're dealing with. You don't have to go to appeal and go back to the board. So in today's dollars, it's a pretty good compromise. We don't want to put a tax on the fund. Actually, I did talk to the Department of Labor and the fund board members about, if this becomes law, that we review this in a couple of years and see how things are going with the fund. I also talked to CFDC. If we had to down the line, give me a couple scenarios on raising the cap or something, but that's all to do with their budget, so I'd have to sit down with the commissioners and really talk that over. But first we'd have to see how the bill does with the fund and how it affects the fund. But right now I think we're pretty safe with the fund as it is, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Jerry? Representative Burke?
Well, through the chair, you just threw out a term there that kind of threw a little hitch in the get-along. You're talking about the payout rates. You're not talking about a cap on the total payouts per claim, because I don't think this has a cap, per se. You're talking about what they're looking at limits for the payouts as per standard, which is raising it from $2,500 to $10,000. So, through the chair, I don't believe that this has a cap on a total payout. Okay, that's what I...
No, I think they said they had one for $250,000.
Right, okay. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Book, well, maybe I misstated how I was going to... It's 39% of my fee that I pay in capped at $50 from CFEC.
Okay.
That goes into the fund, not anything to do with the fund itself that pays off the medical.
Thank you.
Representative Newman.
Is there any more community discussion?
I thought you had a question. My apologies. Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thank you.
Good big wife, yeah.
I'll just hear all the time.
Is there anybody else in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Is there anybody online? And with that, we'll close out public testimony and bring it back to the committee. Any questions for anybody? From anybody? What are the wishes of the committee?
Chair, I move House Bill 207, version /A, from committee with any individual recommendations and fiscal notes.
Seeing no opposition, the bill will move out of committee and we will take a brief of these. Back on the record, the last item on the agenda today is the continuation of the public testimony on House Bill 37. The last date that we had public testimony, we didn't get out to the LIOs too much. I think we got one or two from each of the LIOs. I think I'm going to start out in Fairbanks and hit half a dozen people, eight people from Fairbanks, and then start rotating. But Zendek, are you with us? And could you please limit your testimony for 2 minutes? We've probably got 35 or 40 people that we're going to try to get through.
Yes, I'm here.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thank you for calling back in again.
Yes, my name's Zin Decker. I live in Fairbanks for over 40 years. I'm a union electrician. I have a real problem with my elected representatives. When they put in legislation that affects my family, my union, or any other union's ability to negotiate a just living wage and retirement adequate to allow my family to stay in Alaska when I retire and sufficient medical coverage when I'm on the job, that non-union employees have very little of, if any. Employees have 401ks only for retirement is not nearly enough even for us, and that was what would eventually happen. HB 37, if put into law, would inevitably lower wages, medical, and retirement benefits for both union and non-union employees throughout Alaska. And no chance of keeping up with inflation, higher cost of living here, even without the economic problems the nation is in now. As my elected representatives, you are about to make a bad decision by voting an HB 37 into law, and Alaska's real economy, overall economy, is at stake and would suffer. States that have the right to work laws give statistics about how many people are working for that move there, but never tell you about the lower wages, lower medical benefits, and retirements that are not sufficient for even their lower cost of living areas. And thank you for it. I'll listen to my comments.
No, thanks again. I believe we were here last time and we weren't able to get to you. John Brown, are you with us?
Yes, John Brown. I'm representing myself. I'm retired operating engineer. I just, real quickly, I mean, there's a lot of people here to testify, but I want to make sure everybody understands this doesn't have anything to do with anybody's right to work. This legislation has been around different states forever. It's been creeping in and creeping in, but the fact is it's about allowing somebody to have something for nothing. And that's not American. It's wrong. The facts are that no matter what industry you work in, whether it, whatever it is, if you're working under a union contract, you're making between 30 and 35% more in wages and benefits. So there's a value to that union contract. But it costs money to put that union contract in place. Any organization has to have resources in order to be in existence. And to say that what this legislation would do would say that individuals get to decide that they're going to take the benefits of that contract, but they're not going to pay anything for it. And all that the unions do now is ask people to pay a fair share. Nobody has to join. No one has to become a member. All they have to do is pay their fair share, meaning they pay the same as everyone else. And it's very minimal. Dues is between 2 and 4% to gain 30 to 35%. It's a good deal. It's good for everybody. It's good for our communities because it It allows wages and benefits to move up with the cost of living, allows our economy to be better with better wages and benefits, more money being spread around. So I urge you strongly not to support this legislation. I've been in this, been in the labor business for a long time. I'd be glad to ask, answer any questions anybody has about this. Thank you.
Thanks again, John. Mike Littlefield.
Yeah, this is Mike Littlefield. I'm a business agent for Teamsters Local 959 here in Fairbanks. We're opposed to House Bill 37, and I'd like to give you about five real quick points on the reasons why. I'm quoting the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics on this, and all this legislation would do would reduce wages for working families nearly $5,500 per year. It's going to increase the poverty rates to over 12.5%. It's going to increase by 21% the people that will not have any adequate health insurance or any health insurance at all. It would also increase the infant mortality rate to over 16%, and personally I find that awfully obscene. And the last thing that this legislation would do, and these are again from the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics, people who are working non-union have a 51% higher death and injury rate on the job, and I just don't think that that's an acceptable level. So from our standpoint and from mine, I find this a direct attack on unions and on the working Alaskans, and I just don't think that this this legislation needs to be passed. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Mike. Zebulon Woodman.
Hi, Zeb Woodman. Ceded his time to Tim Sharp. My name is Tim Sharp. I'm the business manager for the Alaska District Council of Labor's. Represent about 5,000 working Alaskans. We also speak strongly against House Bill 37. Much like sovereignty for tribes or Israel's right to exist, this is a sensitive one for organized labor, and I think the sponsors of the bill calculated it to be exactly that. It's just concerning to me that at a time when we have some pretty big issues facing Alaskans, like the gas line, energy concerns, a huge recession approaching, I'm not sure why anyone would choose this time to prioritize picking a fight with organized labor and Alaskan working people. The right to work for less loss, the track record speaks for itself nationwide, as does the record of organized labor, the only force that drives up better wages, benefits, and working conditions for Alaska. It seems that some of our legislators have decided the real problem in Alaska is that working people in the state are making too much money, so they want to bring the average wage down for all Alaskan workers, union and non-union. The right to work for less law is designed by business to legislatively kill or neuter unions, the only remaining viable voice for the American worker. When this has happened in most other states, wages drop or stagnate, and benefits atrophy or go away. Why would anyone want this for Alaskans? Though unions represent 12 to 14% of the American workforce nationwide, in Alaska we represent four, or one out of four, or one out of five workers, 20 to 25%. Our average wages and benefits in Alaska show the results of those demographics. The sponsors of this bill are also swimming upstream in terms of the opinion of most Americans. As recently as 3 weeks ago in the Parade magazine, there's a national poll showing 92% of Americans still support the need for labor unions. They certainly don't support the need for more weakened unions. It's curious to me that some of the very same people that oppose minimum wage increases, improved safety and health standards, prevailing wage standards, and project labor agreements are connected with sponsoring this bill. Some people look for fights and problems to cover up and take the people's focus away from the truly important issues on Alaska's plate right now. Possibly that's going on with this type of legislation. There's an old Irish saying that goes, may the devil take the toes of all our foes that we would know them by their limping. As far as our labor organization goes, anyone that votes to support the right to work for less law for Alaskans will be seen as limping. Our record speaks for itself also. Please vote against any movement of this waste of Alaskan people's working, Alaska people's important time. It's bad for unions, bad for workers, and bad for Alaska. Don't we have some real issues to deal with this close to the end of session? I'd also appreciate any moment left to me to respond to Dimitri Kazars, the National Right to Work representative that phoned in from from Washington, D.C. the other day, if that's okay with the chair, if I have any time left.
Actually, you're out of time, but thank you. Any questions for Tim? Randy Griffith.
Hello, my name is Randy Griffin, Post Office Box 73653, Fairbanks, Alaska. I am in favor of HB 37, the right to work law, and the reason I'm in favor of it is because I am pro-freedom. The United States is supposed to be a country of freedom. Alaska is supposed to be the land of the free. And freedom to me means where one individual, like me, can make a deal with any other individual in this room. We don't have to have any guns pointed at our heads or any coercion directed from the federal government. To me, that's what freedom is. And also, freedom is recognizing the right to private property, and I strongly believe in that. That's what gives the United States its strength. We've lost many freedoms in this country, but we still have many, many freedoms, such as being able to testify here. I'm grateful for that. I've worked as a union member in the 1970s. I was a laborer on the pipeline and up at the North Slope. More recently, I've been non-union, working as a building maintenance guy. To me, what's wrong here is the law. The National Labor Relations Act, which started in 1935, is wrong, aspects of it, though during the years since it's been improved a bit. The first law before that, in 1932 or so, the National Industrial Recovery Act, was struck down as unconstitutional, just like the minimum wage was originally struck down as unconstitutional. And that's really a wrong thing. I mean, we all want as high wages we can get, but that's wrong, forcing people from the deals that they want to make. Now, union people are good, and everybody wants good working conditions, and so do I, and high wages, but it's whether we stick a gun at someone's head to get them, you know, that's what's wrong. The unions, if they go, you know, ramp, you know, if they get out of hand, they can destroy the steel industry, the auto industry, and a lot of people think that the unions raise wages. They certainly do, but they don't raise the total productivity of the nation. Therefore, they don't raise the whole lot of the boats. I see I've gone over time, and I don't want to be unfair. So, yes, on HB 37. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Randy. Mark Dragas. Are you with us, Mark?
Yeah, this is Mark Dragas. You know, I'm a 39-year resident of Alaska, and I'm a my occupation is as a battalion chief in the Fairbanks Fire Department. I'm also a president of the Alaska Professional Firefighters Association, and I'm here representing them. Our firefighters and paramedics, almost 500 of them, respond to 75% of the 911 calls in Alaska. And I just want to say categorically, I'm opposed to House Bill 37. And in response, I want to make to things that were said by Representative Gatto. In Alaska, there's no prohibition for any of our members to volunteer in a volunteer fire department. That is, no member has ever been disciplined, at least in the last 20 years, for any type of that activity. It happens here in Fairbanks. It happens in many locations in the state. So, anyway, with that, I'll close my testimony.
Well, thanks again, Mark. We're going to go to Kina next.
I only got one.
Chris Garcia. How are you doing, Chris?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Garcia is in another hearing right now, but we do have Mr. Tim Evans who's ready to testify.
I'll take Tim.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman Olson. My name is Tim Evans. I am a retiree most of the time. Anyway, I'm very, very much opposed to House Bill 37, and a few of the reasons are all wages, but both non-union and union, are lowered. Benefits are reduced or eliminated. 21% more people lack health insurance in right-to-work states. Safety and health standards are reduced in non-free bargaining unit states. Workplace deaths are at least 51% higher in right-to-work states. Fairness. Why should someone be allowed to enjoy the benefits of a bargaining unit and not pay their share? The union must provide the same representation for non-member employees. Why would anyone want to work at a union workplace? Obviously, to obtain better wages, benefits, and representation. So if you want to go to work there to attain these benefits, but not to be members of a union, the majority of employees are harmed because of the minority. That is not the American way. If your opponent in state elections obtained 30% of the vote, does that mean he or she has the right to represent that district 30% of the time? No, that would be ridiculous. And so is right-to-work legislation. It is not the workers' employees that benefit from such legislation, but the greed of corporations and large contractors. That greed is what has led to the meltdown of our country today. Please do not add to the problem. Please vote no on House Bill 37. Thank you.
Thanks again, Tim. What's the volcano doing?
It's kind of smoking right now, but it's snowing a little bit.
Okay. I didn't want to hear that. Ellen Bede, are you with us?
Mr. Chair, this is the Kenai moderator. Mr. Garcia has returned, and he's ready to give his testimony.
Hello, Chris.
Oh, right. Hey, I'm Chris Garcia. I'm from Kenai, Alaska. I'm here just representing myself, and I'd like to voice my opinion to vote against this bill. And I've worked around the country in various different places and have worked in right-to-work states. And I got one point I would like to make. Calling right-to-work would be like putting a euthanasia pro-abortion bill in the House and calling it right-to-life. It is absolutely wrong. It's got nothing to do with the right to work. It's the right to slavery. And I'm opposed to it. I hope our state stays opposed to it, and our families will live a lot better without it. Thank you very much.
Well, Chris, you want to weigh in on the Fisherman's Fund, too?
Yeah, I'm definitely in favor of that.
We moved it out.
I know you've moved it out of committee, but I think it's a good thing.
Thanks again, Chris. Brandon Michaels.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Mr. Alan Butte is next on the list, too. He's ready.
Alan, are you still there?
Speaking. Hey, while listening to all these people, my blood's boiling there, so anything's able to fall out here, but totally against this bill.
Can you state your name and affiliation, Alan, for the record?
I'm retired now.
Oh, no, we just need your name for the record.
Alan Butte.
Okay, I see at least one question for you, but please continue. Okay. Somebody here knows you.
Give me my 2 minutes.
You got them.
Okay. Listen, I thought everything I think about there is Vico and Bill Allen. We're coming back, and this stuff's coming in. And I mean, this is about as ugly as it gets. I just come back from vacation in Arizona. You know, there's people out there looking for work for $4 or $5 an hour, and all this bill is going to do is have people coming from India and China. The only reason I can live here is because I got a decent retirement. And like I said, the old blood's boiling pretty good here with this bill. But if you're serious about any kind of labor issues, what about all these years we've been up here? You never dealt with local hire. That planes, if anybody ever comes up on that plane from Salt Lake City, they go right. They got it timed, so they get right off of that plane, and they've been doing this for 30 some years, and go right to the slope. Why isn't anybody talking about that issue? Those project labor agreements, that way we can control local hire. And that's the biggest thing right here is local hire. We got to take care of our own. And this right to work, man, that's enough. I got to take it easy here.
Okay. Alan, Representative Book has a question for you.
Al, are you there?
Yeah, you betcha.
Hey, are you still driving school bus?
You know what? I'm retired from that, too. Me and my wife were supposed to be retired, and now she went back to work, so I'm retired, and that's why I'm sitting here getting all fired up.
Well, maybe you ought to get behind that wheel and get rid of some of this stress.
Those kids said they can't take it no more. They can't listen to me belly aching no more. Hey, don't pass this bill, whatever you do.
Is that your final word, Al?
Never.
Yeah, no. You're going to hear a lot of me now the more this stuff comes up.
Bill Warren, you don't get to talk this time until we get through everybody else, but we're not ignoring you. We're just going to let everybody else get a chance. But
this is it.
All right, Kurt.
I just want to
holler. How about Shane's testified. How about Richard Hendren, Matsu?
Still have Brandon Nichols, Mr. Chair, and Kenai still.
Pardon me?
We still have Brandon Nichols and Kenai.
I thought we had Brandon. Okay, Brandon. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name is Brandon Nichols, and I'm with the IBEW, and I'm strongly opposed to House Bill 37. I think unions in our state have been a great asset to our workers. They improve safety and give them good jobs, medical benefits, and retirement. Union-friendly states have employees that have higher wages and more medical coverage, and union-friendly countries are much more prosperous than countries that are opposed to them. I can't think of a country that is opposed to unions that we want to try to emulate. Please don't support House Bill 37. That's it.
Well, thanks again. Bear with me, Richard Hendren. Are you with us, Richard?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman, I am.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record. Thank you for sticking around.
Oh, no worries. I have no affiliation other than being an Alaskan citizen, and I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to offer testimony in support of this legislation. HB 37 rights a significant flaw in Alaskan labor law and restores liberty to Alaskan citizens. Each of you on taking office swore an oath to uphold the Constitution, and today you have an opportunity to do just that. Alaska's Constitution is dedicated to the principles that all persons have a natural right to life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and the enjoyment of the rewards of their own industry. Entrusting you, our elected officials, with the protection of these rights, we the people consent to governance, and we obey the laws that you make, not simply because you write them, but because they are just. For any law to be binding on the people, it must be just, meaning that the restrictions imposed must be necessary to protect the rights of the citizens and be proper in that they must not violate the pre-existing rights of the people upon whom they are imposed. Yet, HS 2310, as currently written, requires payment of a portion of the rewards of some Alaskans' industry to private organizations that they may or may not support. Even when support of labor organizations is contrary to the religious beliefs of the citizen, the rewards of their industry are still required to be forfeited to the organization, which then donates an equivalent fund to the charity of its choice, not the citizens. This law is patently unjust, forcing Alaskans to provide a portion of their wages in support of a union that is not necessarily to protect the right of, that is not necessary to protect the right of citizens, nor is it proper as it violates the right to enjoyment of rewards of their industry as guaranteed by the Alaskan Constitution. You will hear and read a great deal of testimony, much written by labor organizations, that paints a bleak picture of workplace Alaska should this legislation pass. Some will remind you that they're watching how you vote on this issue. Some of you may have long-standing affiliations or even receive generous contributions to your campaigns from labor and feel the need to support them. I urge you not this time. The price is simply too high. The natural rights of the citizen must prevail. I ask that you respect your oath to uphold the Constitution by supporting the right of citizens to determine how they best enjoy the rewards of their industry. Remember that first come the inalienable rights granted us by our Creator, and next comes the law of government. Thank you.
Thank you. Question from Representative Book.
Is this Jerry?
Richard Hendren.
Richard, I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Can you still hear me?
Yes, sir.
So you're standing up for yourself as an individual in this regard?
Yes, sir, I am.
Who stands up for you besides yourself in this issue?
I would imagine that would be you, Representative Booth.
It would be. And it was me before I took this job. Do you know what that job was, sir?
No, sir, I don't.
It was a union organizer. My job was to represent you, the unrepresented union, the unrepresented worker. And in your neighborhood, I did that to the tune of $250,000 for unrepresented workers. Are you aware of that?
No, sir, I don't know you personally.
You don't need to know me, and that's one of the reasons that we stand up for you as a worker.
Well, thanks again, Richard.
Thank you, sir. I would appreciate it if you do stand for this bill.
I'm going to move into the committee room now. We have some people that haven't had a chance and have been trying to jump around the state, but I think I'm going to go to one guy that's up from Anchorage, or down from Anchorage. Vince, are you still with us? Are you hiding back there? Please join us.
Getting in front of a bunch of Juneau folks when it comes to Anchorage.
Sounds like your problem, not mine. I just want to see him get back on the plane.
I appreciate the opportunity, Chairman Olson. Before the timer starts, if I...
Name and affiliation for the record.
Vince Beltrami, I'm president of the Alaska AFL-CIO, and I wanted to pass on a message. Last Wednesday, we had probably over 30 people in the Anchorage LAO. There was 30, 35 people in the Fairbanks and others that never got an opportunity. I don't know how many of them came back. And that they were a little concerned, and I'm just passing on that concern, that they didn't get enough time to say what they wanted, and yet the guy not from Alaska who called in from Washington, D.C. on behalf of the National Right to Work Committee got 5-10 minutes or something.
But actually, the former commissioner got even longer than him.
Anyway, I just wanted to make, before I started my comments.
Yeah, he was with the sponsor. He was the sponsor's.
Okay, fair enough.
The commissioner got more time than he did.
Well, we got a couple other commissioners back here, too. I hope they get an opportunity.
Okay, the clock's running, Vince.
Well, just allow, if you'll allow me. In the right-to-work states, there's, on average, I want to go over a couple statistics. On average, women make 25% less. African Americans make 22.5% less, and Hispanic workers make 37% less, not to mention the disparity between union workers and non-union workers of over 30%. So this actually has a more negative impact on women and people of color. I've seen a lot of the statistics, and I hope not to go into a lot of those, but to address some of the other concerns about forcing people to join unions and the concern regarding freedom of association, those things are already guaranteed by law, and they've been settled years ago in Supreme Court cases, and it was most of what the sponsors' statements had to do with. Those things are already covered. They were covered in General Motors versus the NLRB and CWA versus Beck many years ago, so they really are already redundant and somewhat moot in this discussion. But I do want to talk about the guy from the National Right to Work Foundation who called in. That organization essentially is the one who promulgates these bills around the country. And they are nothing more than a front, basically funded by big corporate business. In fact, one of the main spokespersons is the billionaire Steve Forbes. So when you get that kind of folks behind the scenes, it really makes me wonder how, you know, it seems like they're quite disingenuous when they come to asking as if they, or acting as if they care about working folks. Right to work laws have nothing to do with constitutional freedoms or personal liberties, as the gentleman just mentioned. This legislation is nothing more than a thinly veiled attempt to allow free riders to get all the benefits without paying their fair share. And as Representative Coghill questioned accurately and assessed, workers who opt not to pay dues, they basically get the full benefit of increases to wages and other fringe benefits without investing in any of the costs associated with that representation whatsoever. And that is flat out un-American. Just to summarize, it's already legal for people to refuse to join a union if they choose and refuse to pay the portion of dues that might go towards the union's political activity. Right-to-work laws hurt union workers as well as non-union workers. They hurt women and minorities more severely than others, and it would hurt Alaska businesses. And all the credible data show negative economic impacts when right-to-work laws pass. Alaska deserves better, and I encourage you not to pass this bill out of committee. Thank you.
Well, I might make a comment at this point in time. It's not my intention to take any action on this bill until everybody has weighed in. In all likelihood, that will not be in the next 4 or 5 days.
Right.
So, I mean, if we have people who still want to testify, we're going to be holding a number of labor and commerce meetings during the interim.
Pardon me, but I do, Mr. Chair, I do know that there are over 50 people in Fairbanks right now. There's around 30 in the Anchorage LIO, and probably, I know, I don't know how many you got to at the Kenai LIO, but there's others around the state, and some have actually dialed in, I believe. So there's probably well over, not to mention the 15, 20 people we have in the room here.
Got them to work on the room right now, and then go back to the LIOs. Any questions for Vince?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vince, did you just say that we're on America? I'm not a union guy, but...
I'm sorry?
You didn't just say, I'm not, I was never a union employee. You didn't say that I was un-American, did you?
Not at all. I'd say it'd be un-American to pass a law like this.
Okay. Well, make sure. I just have
to. The chair.
Everybody has their opinion. I've got some questions here, and I get somewhat confused, and I'll get this information to you after you testify here this evening, because I really remember it, and it was from the United Food and Commercial Workers, UFCW. And there's a trumpet in the background.
Sorry about that, Mr. Chairman. He's in front of you.
Or on me.
And it talks about the retirement benefits. And the benefit actuarial rate has been reduced to 0% this year. Since the beginning of covered hours earned April 1, 2009, the benefit accrual rate has been reduced to 0%. That means the plan does not currently provide for any additional benefits after March 9. And it consecutively goes from on or before March 31st, 1991, and it started out that your future service benefit is, it was a dollar amount then of 0.037, and then from 92 to 98 it was 4.45% of employers' contributions, 99 to 06 it went to 4.3%, and in 07 to 09 it went to 2.5, so a reduction in the amount of employer benefits contributions that were there. And now, again, the actual rate that's going into your retirement benefits is zero, and it's trying to, I guess, make it whole. And it has to do with, I believe, probably the stock market and losses in the stock market. And I think it was the point that I'm trying to get is that was when the state had to go through our tier 1, 2, 3, and 4. I think it was because of the same thing. So just the state was trying to, the money wasn't there to make sure that we could guarantee the retirement contracts that we had in place, there had to be a reduction. And nobody wants to see that. I don't care. The union, nobody wants to see that. But I just want to point these things out that if you're a union employer or non-union, everybody gets hurt, you know, in a bad economy. Everybody is forced to make some tough decisions at times on benefit rates, retirement amounts, whether union or non-union, and that's just the name of the game. I guess more of a statement if you'd like to comment on any of that, and I want to get this to you maybe next time around when we go to this. I want to make sure that you have a fair chance at this.
Well, through the chair, Rep. Neiman, it's not uncommon for, you know, pension funds to have to look at adjusting their actuarial assumptions based on what's going on in the market. You hit the nail on the head. In good years, they've been allowed to increase those benefits. And, of course, when there's a tough economy and the market has gone down, and I would actually, the comment I would make is the reason that the economy has gone down as bad as it has is because of poor investments that were made with, you know, American taxpayers' pension monies. By Wall Street folks that decided to act on those, you know, with our money, essentially make bad investments on fake paper, and now we're all bearing the brunt of that. Those poor decisions, and that was a result, you know, I believe, of workers not having enough voice. Now, if you pass legislation like this, that just exacerbates that problem. It'll make it even worse going down the road. I mean, the defined benefit programs actually, while they've suffered, they've done significantly better than the defined contribution programs, which have suffered even worse. And that's what, unfortunately, if non-union employees are in any kind of a plan whatsoever, it's usually in a defined contribution plan. We have real good defined benefit pension plans, and as those come back, they'll kind of lead the way again for the rest of the workforce. So, if that...
I guess just the point I was trying to make is there's no guarantees. It doesn't matter if you're union or non-union. There just cannot be a guarantee.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks again, Vince. We've got three more people in the room, and then we will go up to Anchorage. Mike Notar. Welcome back.
Thank you, Chairman Olson, committee members. My name is Mike Notar. I'm president of the Juneau and Vicinity Building and Construction Trades Council. HB 37 is a proposed abomination on the state of Alaska and its working people. And I can almost guarantee you that it was not filed at the request of Alaskan working families. This bill would make Alaska a right-to-work state, which in and of itself is an appalling misnomer, as though somehow workers did not already have an inherent right to work. It should simply be called work for less. This is just union busting disguised with a nice-sounding label. These laws weaken unions' abilities to collectively bargain by prohibiting union security provisions in collective bargaining agreements both approved by a majority of the employees and the employer. These provisions provide that all that benefit from a collective bargaining agreement should pay their fair share of the costs of that union representation. In the Supreme Court decision in 1977, in Abood versus Detroit Board of Education, the court said, quote, a union shop arrangement has been thought to distribute fairly the cost of these representative activities among those who benefit, and it counteracts the incentive that employees might otherwise have to become free riders. To refuse to contribute to the union while obtaining benefits of union representation that necessarily accrue to all employees, unquote. Worst of all, these laws translate into lower wages and benefits, a diminished standard of living, and substandard legal protections for workers in those states with these laws. Let's remember, when wages fall, so do dollars circulating in Alaska's economy. Certainly not something we presently need, given the state of our national and state economies. Alaska doesn't want or need this regressive sort of legislation. HB 37 is a dreadful public policy and is not being asked for by working Alaskans, and I urge you all to vote against passing it out of committee. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Mike.
Thank you.
Tom Cashin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Cashin. I'm a retired IBEW worker. I was a former commissioner of labor during the first Knowles administration. I spent a lifetime in the labor movement in Alaska. One of the electrical industry training centers in Anchorage is named Tom Cashin Electrical Training Center. The other one is the Cornfine Training Center in Fairbanks, an old mentor of mine. But I don't want to take up a lot of your time because you'll hear lots of testimony on and on and on from people that are in the business still, and I'd just like to add my name to the list of people that oppose this legislation. Thank you for...
Appreciate you coming in, and will you take the question, Representative Book?
This isn't a question.
Uh-oh, a statement.
This is a commentary. Through the chair, Mr. Cashin, I appreciate your former service. I appreciate the endeavor that you've made on the behalf of workers across the state, and the way that you've issued yourself in that command and in those endeavors. I also really appreciate the slogan that you proffered. I keep it around as a memory, and I think that this would be a testimony to that if it would get passed. And I think I'll just leave it at that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That was my first press conference, and I almost got fired.
Well, I didn't hear it.
I think what we have to do is go off the record.
Brief please.
Okay.
Yeah. Your efforts to get everybody heard on this, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
With that, we're going to go to Anchorage. We've got a number of people signed up there. And again, for those that weren't in the room at the LIO half hour ago, we're not going to be taking any action on this bill until everybody's had a chance to weigh in. And that best guess would be that we'll probably be having some all-day meetings during the interim. But we're there's not going to be any action in the next several days. Rick Connolly, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Yes, sir. My name is Rick Connolly. I'm a business representative for the Teamsters Local 959 here in Anchorage. Having come to Alaska from a state that now has the right-to-work legislation in place, I have personally witnessed, and my family that is still there have endured the hardships that are brought about through misguided lawmaking such as this. We've listened to a number of people state facts of how the workforce, both union and non-union, are impacted through this type of legislature, the reduction in wages, the reduction in benefits, and the difficulties that are compounded in the union's aspect where it comes to the ability to negotiate strong collective bargaining agreements and to successfully represent their membership in a time where our state faces uncertain economics. I cannot think of a worse time to introduce such an ill-conceived notion as House Bill 37. Workers, union workers in this state have, since statehood and before, have provided stellar labor and services for the people of this state. I think it is quite a troublesome payback to attempt to derail the faithful workers that are represented by the organized labor organizations in this state. I implore you to not pass this out of committee, to kill this, and maybe do that just as a show of gratitude and thanks to those who precede us and those who are going to work with us side by side now and that will follow us in the future. Give us the opportunity to get the best for our people, that they may give the best back to the state. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Rick. We'll stick with another Rick. Rick Traney, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name is Rick Traney. I'm the executive director of Teamsters Local 959 for the state of Alaska. I would urge you to vote no on House Bill 37. This bill would subvert the collective bargaining process. The workplaces that have union agreements have better wages, health care, benefits, and work rules. I would state my objection to the gentleman from Kenai who says they're not more productive. I mean, the common argument we make at the negotiating table is that we do have more productive workforces, and we're held to that standard, and we don't mind being held to that standard because in return we ask for these better wages and conditions. Bargaining units have negotiated better terms of employment contract after contract, and these gains are solidified and passed on to successive employees and generations of successive employees. The collective bargaining process that secures these gains for employees is dependent on the employees participating as a whole. To allow other employees to secure these gains while not participating in the process defeats the inherent purpose of having a bargaining unit and the process and vote by the other employees to be represented by a union. It concerns me that this bill is before you today. I believe in the National Labor Relations Act and the Public Employee Relations Act. I do not see at this time where they would need amending or changes to. I would urge you to the legislature to do the business of the people and not needlessly attempt to amend the laws unnecessarily. Passing this bill makes the existing bargaining units less secure in their position, weakens safe workplace rules, lowers wages and benefits, and tilts the balance of the employer-employee relationship unfavorably in regards to the employee. Additionally, I would urge you not to limit testimony in such a landscape-changing bill to 2 minutes for all those wishing to testify. Their testimony should be heard in full. Again, I would urge you to vote no. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Barbara Huff for the bagels at the next meeting. Jed Whitaker.
Hello, my name is Jed Whitaker. I'd just like to form the committee that there's about 40 people here that are probably not going to have the opportunity to be heard today. Right to work law is a red herring that poses as freedom of the individual, but in reality it's designed to weaken unions, weaken collective bargaining, and to keep wages low. As a result, right-to-work states have a lower per capita income and a higher rate of poverty. Unions brought America to the middle class through the minimum wage, the 40-hour work week, overtime pay, health care benefits, and pension plans and worker safety. A healthy economy is one in which people have money in their pockets. Henry Ford understood this. In the beginning, Ford paid his workers $5 a day, an unheard of wage. He was asked why, and he said, "Who'll buy my cars?" Republicans in Congress blame General Motors and Ford's problems on the unions. However, an article in the Wall Street Journal noted that the money that General Motors and Ford put into their companies over the last 10 years could have bought Toyota, Honda, and Nissan outright. Obviously, poor management and poor asset allocation. Yet Republicans don't blame the management. They blame the unions for General Motors and Ford's problems. I don't understand why Republicans seem to hate unions. I'm here to tell you that unions don't hate Republicans. My union, Local 341, the laborers, we endorse Ted Stevens and Don Young. So I do not support House Bill 37, and I urge its defeat. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Larry Bronson, are you with us? Representative Newman has a question.
Mr. Whitaker, I'm a Republican, and I don't hold anything against unions or non-unions. I look at legislation, and I try and look at everything with an open mind. So as a Republican, I'm not anti-union, just for the record. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Larry Bronson, are you with us?
Larry Benson?
American Postal Workers?
Right, Larry Benson.
Sorry about that.
Good afternoon, Chairman Olson and committee. I'm Larry Benson, President of the American Postal Workers Union, and I am representing the American Postal Workers Union. Right now, we're living through a profound financial crisis, and the real roots lie in the weakening of the American economy. House Bill 37 lends to a further weakening of the economy with intent of low wages, jobs with no benefits, and an unsustainable effort to maintain a middle-class living standard. For 30 years, America's economic elites and their political allies, such as the National Right to Work Group, have pursued policies designed to produce this a low-wage level economy, just as House Bill 37 does. At the same time, policymakers have sought, with some success, to maintain high levels of consumer spending. Now, the creation of this low-wage, high-spending economy has systematically destroyed the various ways we individually and collectively save and invest. Instead of an income-driven economy, we have become an economy driven by asset bubbles fueled with cheap debt. And the ultimate unsustainability of this strategy has brought us to our current crisis. The assault on good jobs has proceeded on two fronts. In the purely domestic realm, starting with the effective abolition of the right to form unions in the private sector, both the formal and informal structures that encourage the growth of worker bargaining power have been dismantled. House Bill 37 will further bring about this dismantling. This bill does nothing to improve an economy driven by wages, but instead drives further into the abyss, an economy driven by asset bubbles fueled with cheap debt again, and will reduce Alaska's wages and jeopardize employer-provided health care. You know, north to the future is Alaska's motto. House Bill 37 does not reflect our true Alaskan spirit. It would be an insult to pass a bill like this. The American Postal Workers Union is opposed to this bill for the reasons I stated, and I urge you to oppose this so-called right-to-work bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Larry. Tim Morgan. Are you with us, Tim?
Yeah, I'm coming up to the mic.
Oh, thanks.
Well, I had a speech written for you guys, but all the statistics were already said. He'd like to make a quick statement and then ask you a question.
Please state your name for the record, Tim.
Oh, Tim Morgan. I'm with Teamsters Local 959. I'm a business representative. The groups that I represent voted the union in by a majority vote, same way you all were voted in to represent your districts by majority. The right to work takes where people don't have to pay anymore if they don't want to belong or to still work in that job. That would almost be like saying, if you didn't vote for me, you don't have to pay a portion of your taxes to pay my wages. And it just doesn't seem right. I definitely urge you guys to vote against House Bill 37. And hopefully it doesn't pass because I'd like my kids and my grandkids to stay up here and work. And they're not going to work in a right-to-work state. They can't ever get ahead. Thanks.
Thanks again, Tim. Dennis Nibel, are you with us?
Yes.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name is Dennis Cable. I'm a member of the IBEW. Chairman, let me take a minute to take a comparison from a small town to a union. In a small town, you have a mayor election, and in a small town, there's a cul-de-sac. And in this cul-de-sac, there are five homes. Two of the homeowners are for one particular candidate, and the other three homeowners are for the other candidate. And that candidate wins. Now, when that mayor raises taxes, all the residents pay. Just as, you know, if the other candidate or the mayor cuts spending, there's cuts for everybody. So in a union, when workers vote to go union, it's for everybody. They vote on their contract, they vote on their and they vote on their bylaws and constitution. So I'm asking this committee to please vote pro democracy, vote no, and right to work. Thank you.
Thanks again, Dennis. Scott Sammons.
Yes, I am Scott Sammons. I'm a member of Labor's Local 341. I'm honored to have this opportunity to speak out against House Bill 37. My family moved to Alaska 6 years ago, seeking a better life than I could provide in my home state of Arkansas. Arkansas is a right-to-work state, and back home in Baxter County, Arkansas, the prevailing wage on a Davis-Bacon job for a licensed electrician is $13.85. As a laborer, if I make $2 over the $6.25 minimum wage, I'm doing very well and considered to be a foreman. In preparing for this discussion, I had to look back at the history of similar legislation and note that most of the states that have gone to right to work did so 50 years ago when Alaska was making the decision not to. Alaska's choice to avoid the rush to join the right to work states after the passage of the Taft-Hartley Act served the state very well. Alaska has prospered, and so has its workers. Alaska's unions provide excellent training, health, and retirement benefits. The benefit offered to Alaska's union-organized businesses in the form of a flexible, highly skilled workforce, affordable insurance, and transferable retirement plans has produced very competitive and profitable companies in our state. The employers need a well-trained, flexible workforce because the days of graduation to retirement with the same company are long past and perhaps were never seen in Alaska. Union membership offers easy transferability of earned benefits from multiple companies. As a state, we need a strong resident workforce, numerous enough to allow growth that our economy demands and flexible enough to meet the needs of our diverse employers. Strong unions create a level playing field by setting the standards of employee compensation for union and non-union companies alike. And without a strong voice to demand fair treatment and compensation for workers, Alaska could easily sink to the standard of living enjoyed in Arkansas, Mississippi, South Carolina, et cetera, et cetera. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ron McPeters.
I'm here. This is Ron McPeters, President of Labor's Local 341.
Well, thank you for waiting as long as you did.
You bet. I thank you for the testimony. I thank you for the opportunity to testify before this body that I respect so much. Labor's Local 341 represents over 2,200 members in South Central Alaska. It is true that the so-called right-to-work legislation would hurt the economy of the state, degrade workers' rights, inflate health care costs, and endanger the safety of employees. The real issue to me is why are we even considering this piece of legislation? Why is this proud committee even considering a move as radical as this? Why would this committee want to remove the organizations that are responsible for training more Alaskans than any other in the history of the state? Why would this committee want to take out the organizations that will assure true Alaskan hire? This is not only true for the laborers, but it's true for all unions in the state. Right to Work for Less laws deliberately intend to financially cripple a union. Without dues, unions have no source of income and will eventually fold, leading to unrepresented workforce that will earn less, spend less, and hurt the Alaska economy. Without a union, workers are less likely to have health care insurance and the top-notch training earned through apprenticeship programs. Without these added benefits, who do you think will be having to pay for these uninsured visits to the hospital? I came here intending to be brief and to the point. And with that, I strongly urge you to vote no on House Bill 37. Thank you, gentlemen.
Ron, I can answer one question. We probably have close to 500 bills in front of us this session. I personally probably disagree or don't like over half of them, and I think I would probably be speaking for everybody at the table on that, but we probably spend more time hearing bills that we have a problem with than we do bills that we agree with. And if we pick and choose, we could be out of here in probably a month, but now that we're cut to 90 days, one of the side effects you're seeing is working public testimony on like we have on this and limiting it to 2 minutes, although I've heard of at least one committee that was limiting public testimony to 1 minute. I don't think I will ever get to the point where I do that, but I apologize to anybody out there, and it is my intent that we're going to hear from everybody that wants to testify before anything happens on this, and given our structure, we can hear testimony during the interim, but we can't take any action on it. So realistically, this bill wouldn't even be considered for any kind of action probably until next year. But with that, we've probably got time for one more person. And again, I apologize to everybody that hasn't had a chance to weigh in yet. But the next time we hear public testimony on this bill, we're going to try to have at least 4 hours minimum blocked off for testimony so we don't have people hanging out there like we probably do now. But Sergio Acuna, you're the last one today. Are you with us still?
Yes, I am. Thank you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify. I'm going to make it short. My name is Sergio Acuna, and I'm a union laborer, and I oppose House Bill 37. As we all know, there is about 22 states with the right to work provisions. Alaska does not need to become the 23rd. I have personally struggled with the consequences of right-to-work laws at the workplace in other states, such as Texas and Nevada, meaning lower wages, disrespect, discrimination, and unsafe working conditions. The work that I perform is very important, and I take pride on what I do. And I just don't deserve more than just enough for beans and tortillas for it. I need decent wages, fair and safe working conditions at the workplace, not just for me, but for my family and all Alaskans. Alaska does not need right to work for less laws. Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, we will conclude the public testimony tonight. And again, I apologize to it looks like there's probably 20 people that we hadn't had a chance to get to tonight, but with that, we'll adjourn the meeting at 5:20.